from the campus of Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington. You're listening to the G Suite Podcast, where we discuss all things Zag business.
Arnie Monlock was the Global Strategic Technology Partner Alliance Leader at Microsoft until his recent retirement. He shares his career journey from finance to marketing and offers insights on hiring and team leadership.
Well, welcome to the G Suite podcast. Gonzaga, what year did you graduate from Gonzaga?
1984.
So take us back kind of to the beginning where you first learned about Gonzaga, how you ended up going or choosing Gonzaga. And again, I don't know where you grew up or
how. I was born and raised in Minnesota.
I heard that in the Minnesota, by the way you said it. So yeah, okay, go on, sir. Sorry.
Yeah, in a town called Little Falls, which is the boyhood home of Charles Lindbergh. And then we moved to Mankato, Minnesota, eventually, where I really grew up. And then when I was 16, unfortunately, my dad was killed in a car accident.
Okay.
And I was the oldest boy in the family. So around that time, you're thinking about college, and I wasn't sure where I wanted to go. I loved Minnesota, and I still love Minnesota. Most of my family is still back there, but I kind of wanted to get out on my own. A lot of responsibility fell on me after my dad's death. My mom never remarried. And the schools in Minnesota that I was considering were kind of too close. So I went to my high school counselor, who was a school sister of Notre Dame, a nun, and she listened to me for a while. She thought, she said, well, what about Gonzaga University? I'm like, Gotta, I've never heard of it. What is it? Garbanzo Bean College? What is this? She's like, well, let me get you a brochure. And I actually still have the brochure. I should have brought it out today, because I just ran across it the other day. I was cleaning out an old memorabilia box, but it's this Gonzaga at the time had a brochure that they made it look like a cover of a National Geographic magazine. And and I'm like, okay, that's kind of cool. And I read through it and I went, sounds good to me. So I applied, obviously got accepted, and then proudly told everybody that I was going to Gonzaga University in Spokane. And everybody's like, where is that? That was right after Mount St. Helens had exploded. And so they were like, isn't that where the volcano is? Or doesn't it rain there a lot? So I just went. It wasn't until I got on the plane all alone, because youngest sister was a baby at the time, and she was born right before my dad was killed, and she was Down syndrome, so she was a pretty high needs. So mom was completely consumed with that. So I was on the plane all by myself, going to this place I had never been to. I'd never been to the state of Washington, never been to Gonzaga. And I thought it was pretty cool until I sat in that plane all alone going, what have I done? I know nobody. I know nothing. In fact, I remember the night before I left, like, I don't even know where I'm living. I don't have a dorm assignment. And so I called and I said, am I supposed to have a dorm? And I'm like, what? You don't have a dorm? And, you know, let me call you back. And literally just before we left for the airport, they called back and they said, you're in a dorm called DeSmet and your roommate's last name is Haggerty. We'll see you later. So I arrived on campus and at the time, well, first at the airport, the Knights picked me up and which was amazing, and took all my luggage and they moved me in. And I remember driving in the car on the way to the to the campus and with a couple other students that had been picked up, and the Knight asked, what dorm are you guys all in? And when I said DeSmet, he goes, oh, that's a great dorm. You're going to love it. And I'm like, so that's how I ended up at Gonzaga. It was quite an experience to get there. But once I got there, I obviously just loved it.
That's incredible. It's funny, the decisions that 18-year-olds make and how they make it.
Totally.
And I would love to see that.
The course of your entire life, you know, you have no appreciation for it at the time, but yeah, those little decisions are huge.
Huge. Yeah. Huge. And if you remember, take a picture of that brochure and email it to me.
Yeah. I have it. It's actually, the box is still out. So I'm kind of a pack rat, to be honest, pretty sentimental. So I've got the facts and figures from Gonzaga back then, how much tuition was, all that, my acceptance letter is in there. So, I'll send it to you.
Awesome. And so, you get on campus. What'd you study? What were you involved in? And then we'll kind of get to your career.
Well, when I was in high school, I was really active in a lot of different things, sports and everything. But one of my favorite programs was called Junior Achievement. I'd been in Junior Achievement for like 3 years. And that this is a lot of people know it from Risky Business. The movie made it kind of famous. But basically, it was a business education program where you got your group of friends together and you create an actual company. You actually sell shares and for $1 a share, and you create a product, you elect officers, you keep the books, there's a marketing person, there's president, so on. And you sell, build, market, and sell that product. And then you wind up the company at the end of the 6 months or whatever it was, and issue an annual report. And I loved it. I knew I wanted business. And I went to the national convention. If you make officer of the year, you know, they have interviews, you take tests. And if you make the national conference, which was held at Indiana University in Bloomington, there was one of the days was called Business, Industry, and Education, where they bring in all these executives from all these companies. And I was leading this group of executives around and said, you know, I'm going to Gonzaga University and going to study business and I want to run a business someday. That was my goal at the time. And they were like, well, there's really just a few paths to get to the top of a company. There's engineering. You could be an engineer and rise your way through the company in engineering. Like that doesn't appeal to me. There's sales, and I'm like, I grew up in Catholic schools selling door to door, you know, candy, newspapers, magazines, subscription. I did not want to do sales and or finance. And I'm like, that's it. I'm going to do finance. I'm going to be a finance major. So I came to Gonzaga. Long story short, came to Gonzaga thinking I was going to be a finance major because that was going to be my path in business. And once I got in, I had to, you know, take all the core classes and one of which was of course, principles of accounting. And I really liked it. And frankly, between us, I really didn't like the finance professor at the time. I didn't think he was. By that time, I was reading a lot about the industry and the trends and everything, and I was kind of a nerd in that way, and I just thought he was out of touch with the latest in finance. And meanwhile, accounting, I was good at, and I liked the professors, Dan Brasich and Kate Carnes, and so then I found out that there were jobs waiting you if you were an accounting major, and that it could lead to a lot of other things, that it was a good profession or major to start with because it gave you such a good foundation of understanding across all business. You could read financial statements, you could understand businesses, and if you went into public accounting, that you'd get exposure to all these different types of businesses and kind of learn how they made money. And so that really appealed to me. And so I went the accounting route. And then at the time, I don't know if you remember this, but at the time that I was there, the School of Business was not accredited. And there was a major for accounting and economics that was actually issued by the School of Arts and Sciences. That also appealed to me from a liberal arts perspective, because I felt like, of course, back then I'm cocky and I was in junior achievement for 4 years. I know all this basic stuff, you know, I don't need principles of marketing and all this stuff. I decided to pursue the accounting and economics major. When the School of Business got accredited a couple of years after I graduated, they had to eliminate that degree out of the School of Arts and Sciences. So technically, I'm not a School of Business grad from Gonzaga. I'm School of Arts and Sciences, which is odd. No,
we'll still hang out with you.
I had to take all the accounting classes, and you know, Dan Brasich was everything. But then I also got to take like Hitler's Germany from Roderick Stackelberg. And, you know, he wrote the book that we used as the textbook. And I love that. And you know, really some of the most memorable classes that I took at Gonzaga were from that liberal arts side. So I feel like I got the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that's how I ended up in an accounting degree.
And then in first step after that, you got hired off.
Yeah, in 84, well, 83 really, the country was in a recession. Gonzaga had not, was not considered a destination school for a lot of the Big Eight. Back then it was the Big Eight to recruit from. I think, who was it? One of the Big Eight had a Spokane office, but none of the others did. And but they all said that the partners would interview for any of the offices of the Big Eight. But nobody was coming to campus. It was very frustrating. So I ended up writing to all of them and applying. And it was actually, we talked earlier about Eileen Johnston. Eileen was a year or two ahead of me, and I guess a year technically, and she had landed a job with Arthur Andersen, so in Seattle. So that was a foot in the door, at least, with somebody from Gonzaga that I knew. And I applied to Andersen. Andersen at the time was considered the Marine Corps, the profession, the top of the top. And in Seattle, it was between Andersen and Deloitte is who is the top firm, the biggest firm in Seattle, but both of them were cutting back that year. So I applied, wrote a letter to Jerry Alden, the recruiter there, and she agreed to have me flown over to Seattle for an interview, which blew my mind. And long story short, I ended up with Arthur Andersen. And so it was, at the time, Eileen was known as Feedy. So I knew her only as Feedy. And Feedy, so I worked together with Feedy for the first couple engagements, which was fantastic. It was a great transition.
She told me that once. Yeah, it was her sister couldn't pronounce sister, I think.
No, Sweetie, I think it was.
Oh, Sweetie. Okay, there you go.
Because her dad, I think, called her Sweetie, and she couldn't pronounce it, so it was Feedy. So she became known as Feedy.
Yeah. Well, and so then, and you talked, and I feel like, you know, the big firms are like an apprenticeship. You've done a lot of things in your career. So we're curious about that career path, what you learned and garnered from each different experience. So go ahead and go roll with that.
Well, it's an interesting point, because the original plan was you hear all the time about, oh my God, they work you to the bone when you go to one of these big firms. You're just a commodity. You're just like a placed on these jobs that are you're working long hours and over weekends. It's just a grind, and you work your way. So my thought was that I'd pay my dues, if you will, for those first 3 years, establish that base, and then leave to do something else. Accounting was always a means to an end, not like I want to be an accountant for the rest of my life. So that was the original plan, was do this for 3 years. But I got there, and the way the big firms work, it almost feels like an extension of college, because you're starting there with, in our case, we're probably at 25, 30 people that started at the same group. They're all this about the same age. There were a couple outliers, but they're pretty much all just, you know, the same age. We're all pretty much single. There were a couple outliers again. But so you kind of hang out with that group, your start group, and you get particularly close with the four or five people that you start with. And then it's definitely an up or out. And I'm sure it's still the same way. Every year there's somebody in your start group that leaves, or, you know, either of their own accord or because the firm decides that that's not a good fit for you. But I loved it. I was shocked at how fun it was. I not only work-wise, I really found it interesting to have all these different clients that had different businesses and how they made money and how they made that. I love manufacturing, where you'd see at the beginning of the line all the raw materials or the components, and then, you know, you follow the path through the assembly line, and then you see the finished product. And I'm like, that was just fascinating to me. I loved it. And then how they made money and how they priced their goods, and understanding their financials and talking with the executives about their the challenges of the business. And I loved it way more than I thought I would. And I also got caught up in the I don't want to call it a rat race, but the drive to get to the next level and get to the next level and get to the next level. And so I ended up staying there 9 years. And at the time, it's like, what's the right time to leave? And to get to the level of management that I wanted to outside of Anderson, I thought I should probably leave at a manager level at Anderson. So I got to manager level. There was dalliance with, should I go for partner or not? And I decided that that was not what I wanted to do. And there was a client that we are a prospect that we were bidding on, named Cafe Acordo, that they, at the time, Seattle was bursting about coffee. Starbucks it wasn't quite on the radar yet. There were just coffee carts on every corner, and the specialty coffee trend was starting. Starbucks was there, but not quite, you know, the big name that they are today. And Cafe Acordo had invented a machine that was a fully automated espresso latte machine, and had a patent on the milk valve. And it was pretty advanced machine that sold. It was a commercial grade machine. So they sold for $17,000 back then. And their biggest client was this Japanese coffee shop chain that was basically the Starbucks of Japan. And they were shipping hundreds of these machines every month out to Japan. And so they were like this media darling. Everything was written about them. Anyway, long story short, we lost the bid. We didn't get the job. Deloitte got the job. But in the process, I got to know the company, and I knew that they were hiring for a chief financial officer because of their huge growth. And they were on the IPO path, which really appealed to me. I really wanted to get to it, to a company that was going to IPO. So I took that job, and that was a fascinating experience, just a completely different experience than being in public accounting when you're actually making the decisions and running the company. It's very, very different. And we went through every phase that you can imagine. High growth. My first task was to figure out a profit sharing plan for employees. And we couldn't build the machines fast enough. And we were attracting all sorts of investor interest. Jack Benaroya was our major investor. We were on the path to going public. Then there were problems with patents and problems with quality, service costs were skyrocketing. I ended up, Jack actually took over the company. Jack Ben Arroyo took over the company and brought in his nephew to run the company, Joe Ben Arroyo. Then one day we were struggling. He had put a bunch of money in. We decided to go to a direct model for distribution. So we opened offices all over the country. And that was a huge mistake. We were bleeding money. I was cutting everything left and right. And the board finally said, they had a board meeting that called me and the founder in and said, can you guys bootstrap this company back to profitability? We're not going public. We're in survival mode. What do you think? And so Kyle Anderson was the founder. He and I talked, and he took research and development and sales, and I took manufacturing, HR, finance, operations, field service, and we bootstrapped the company back to profitability. And that's when I decided to leave. So that was a huge education in an arc of, you know, being the sexy, high growth, really fun, you know, doing everything company to holy crap, we're in survival mode. And so I decided to leave and found another job as a CFO of a company called Kistler Morse up in Bothell. Kind of a complete opposite. They had been a family run company, but there was a company called Danaher Corporation, which is already a publicly traded New York Stock Exchange company based in the East Coast, ironically founded by some former Arthur Anderson guys. They were in an acquisition mode. Their business model was buying underperforming family-run companies that had high-quality products, and then they would apply their Danaher business principles to the company. I never heard of Danaher, but they had bought this company called Kistler Morse, their first foray into the Seattle area. They made ultrasonic transducers and strain gauge that measured weight and levels for big manufacturing companies. So like if you're driving along the highway and you see a big commercial farm that has a big silo, somehow they need to measure what's in that silo. So they can either do that with ultrasonic transducers that sit at the top and they shoot down to see what the level is. So that's the level side. Or they can put strain gauges, these gauges that have piezo ceramic crystals that when they get compressed, that creates an electronic signal. And the stronger the signal, the heavier the weight. So there's a computer that translates how much weight that is. So you put strain gauges on the feet or the sides of the silos. So I learned everything about weight and level system. But they had bought that company, and they brought in a young MBA from University of Michigan that was running the company, and then he needed a right-hand man CFO. So I went to Danaher, and that was the best run company I've ever worked for. Danaher was amazing. The Danaher business system was based on the Toyota system, as well as brought in a lot of lean manufacturing processes, Six Sigma. It was a machine, and they would turn these companies from these sleepy family-run companies into cash machines, and then that would just further their acquisitions. So shortly after I went there, they bought Fluke up in Everett, and Jim, the president of Kistler Morse, got transferred up to Fluke, and he wanted to bring me with him. So I knew I was on that path. And if I did that, that the next career move after that would be to another Danaher company, likely back east, Ohio, Pennsylvania, somewhere in there. That did not appeal to me. So I was really deciding, like, should I take this role up at Fluke or not? And then I went to a Gonzaga golf tournament in the Seattle area and ran into Mike Lucarelli, who he and I had played trumpet together in the Gonzaga Jazz Band, and he was a phenomenal trumpet player. We were good friends, and you know, we hadn't seen each other in years and years. And so he's like, "What are you doing?" And I, you know, career wise, and I said, kind of gave him a brief update, and told him that I was really trying to decide whether to go up to Fluke in Everett or not. And he said, "Don't do that. Come to work for me at Microsoft. I need good people. I've got this job that I'd love to have you." And so, like, oh, okay, Microsoft or Fluke. And now in hindsight, it looks like, oh, that's a no-brainer. But that was a really, really difficult decision, because I was doing really well with Danaher, loved the Danaher business system, loved what Danaher was all about. I didn't want to move my family and disrupt them by moving back east. But there was kind of this known path that was consistent with what I wanted to do when I was younger. So, and Microsoft at the time was, it was doing well, but the internet was just starting to emerge, and there was questions whether Microsoft was missing out on the opportunity of the internet or not. So I wasn't quite sure if best days were behind it. So, I reached out to some headhunters that I had worked with in some of the previous job changes and said, okay, you know me, you know my background. 5 years from now, if you look back at my resume and you see 5 years of Microsoft or 5 years at Danaher, what's more valuable? No, that's a no-brainer. It's Microsoft. You got, you know, that would be a huge asset on your resume. So I took the job with Microsoft, even though I had no idea what I was doing and what the job was. And the job was knowledge manager. I was hired as a knowledge manager at Microsoft. No idea what that was. and did a bunch of, you know, research trying to figure out what my job was going to be. And Mike was like, just trust me, you'll figure it out. I just need smart people on this project that he was in charge of. So I went to Microsoft. So, and then I stayed there for 21 years, which is just unbelievable.
Yeah, that's my next question, actually. What kept you there for 21 years?
Well, when I started, I really didn't know what I was doing. It turned out it was more on the communications and marketing side, even if it was focused internally. And Mike, I got introduced to the life in big companies shortly after I started, because there was a reorganization that was announced. Mike's team, all of our team, got moved into a new group. Mike had been at Microsoft quite a while at that point. Mike was not happy about that move, and he didn't get the promotion that he was looking for at that time. And so he said, I'm leaving to join a different group within Microsoft. So I was suddenly exposed and didn't know what I was going to do. And the new group that I was in didn't, you know, part of the reason that they moved me, I moved the group, was that they wanted to align kind of similar efforts in under one umbrella, and they didn't see the value of this knowledge manager role or function, and frankly I wasn't sure if I did as well. So they moved me into this other role once he understood what my background was, and that led to little did I know that was a 5-year project that it was on. So I felt like I blinked and 5 years had passed. It was an intense worldwide project, and it was fun in the standpoint of I got to travel around the world. It was a really complicated, really interesting, really challenging project. And Microsoft was full of people that were super sharp, really good, really driven. But I finished that project. I'm like, okay, now I want to get into what I was interested in the first place at Microsoft, which is, one thing I didn't mention, when Mike started, when he hired me, it was in the sales and marketing group within Microsoft, which is a big gap in my mind of my experience that would make me appeal to a general management position. But then when I got reorged, we got moved into an internal IT organization. So once I finished that project, I'm like, I'm not an IT guy. I need to get out of IT. But like I said, the time just, it's like you're in a time warp when you're at Microsoft. It just, you're so busy and you're so heads down. Everything is flying at you that you take a second and you look up and 5 years have passed. But I wanted to get out of IT. Went over, finally found a job in back in marketing. And in Microsoft parlance, it was in partner marketing, which I didn't even know what a Microsoft partner was. But in Microsoft parlance, a partner is any organization that works with or depends on Microsoft technology. They sell it, they service it, they build on it. So that's a partner. So I went into partner marketing and specifically partner competitive marketing. So at the time, Microsoft was competing against Linux and open source and then traditional competitors like Oracle and so on. And our job as partner marketers was to create loyalty with our partners. So they recommend Microsoft products over the competitors or build on our technology over competitors. It's a whole new introduction to what the Microsoft partner ecosystem is. And just to give you a matter of scale, there were about 300,000 partner organizations that Microsoft works with. It's a tiered model with managed relationships at the very, very top to broad scale general marketing through websites and articles and newsletters and that sort of thing. So we were more on the broad scale marketing side. But that led to a career in partner marketing, and I got very interested in partner marketing. My scope expanded. I was moving up in the organization. I did enjoy it. It was what I really wanted to do. Had an opportunity, and that was at the U.S. level. So we were responsible for the U.S. There was an opportunity to move to the global side of partner marketing. So I took that opportunity. So to answer your question, it was just this series of breadcrumbs, you know, that kept me interested and engaged. That was just super interesting. I create a passion about partners, and then that led to this, and then, oh, that's really interesting. And at Microsoft, there were limitless opportunities. As you moved up, they became more narrow, but there were still opportunities. And, oh, I have this US experience. Now I could gain worldwide experience. And so there was always just something that kept me interested. And literally it was, you look up and 20 years have passed, and it doesn't feel like that at all. As I think back on my career, I think of Arthur Andersen, who was there for 8 or 9 years as my core, of my career, not Microsoft. Microsoft, it's like in dog years here or something. It just flew by like that. But I got some great opportunities, and everything was an opportunistic move within that. And it wasn't like there was a planned career that, you know, and I defy anyone to say they've executed against their original career plan exactly as planned. Maybe an attorney or an engineer, but you see opportunities and you take those opportunities and things that interest you that you develop a passion for, and you grab onto those opportunities. So I ended up in a role where I worked with the largest, so the very top of the pyramid of the Microsoft partner ecosystem, companies called what Microsoft called ISVs, independent software vendors, that were other software companies that depended on Microsoft technology. So my team managed the relationships with companies like SAP, which I just read today, they're now the Europe's most valuable company. They make, I think actually Microsoft or Gonzaga runs on SAP, if I'm not mistaken, but it's a ERP, enterprise resource planning software based in Germany. So I was in charge of the SAP relationship. We had my team was responsible for Adobe and the Adobe relationship. So we're working with them to build all their software on the Microsoft cloud, that they have great integrations with Microsoft products, including Word and Excel and all the Office products. So my team was responsible for that relationship of this handful of really big, really important customers. It was a very high stress job, but I loved it because we felt like, well, one thing that I say is that, I don't know if you'll like this or not, but in accounting, what I found was that you're always, especially in public accounting, you're reporting the news. You know, you're kind of looking back and saying, here's how you did for this period. Here's what you could have done better. Here are the mistakes you made. You know, so it's always this kind of look back, and you're reporting the news. In a role like I was in with SAP and Adobe and so on, I felt like we were making the news. You know, we were negotiating the contracts with Adobe for literally over $1 billion that would then, you know, we'd issue joint press releases, and we'd have a big event with Satya and the presidents of these companies coming out and announcing this new integration or this new development where we were doing joint innovation together. That was really exciting, but very stressful. And by the time I was done, I needed a break and decided that the time was right to just retire and take that break. And so, you know, that was 3 years ago, and I don't see myself going back anytime soon. I'm enjoying this life too much.
If you see Bill Gates at the Cheesecake Factory, does he say hi, Arnie? Or
no. actually, the funny thing is, I did meet Bill once, but it was before I started at Microsoft. When I was still at Arthur Andersen, I was elected treasurer of the Washington Software Association, and I had all the high technology companies in my portfolio at Andersen. So that was kind of my business area, was business development area was software. And so I was on the DIOS when he was the guest speaker, and got to meet him there. And then I mentioned my passion for junior achievement when I was in high school. I became a junior achievement advisor when Arthur Andersen sponsored a junior achievement company. And Libby Gates was also at Andersen at the time, and that's Bill's sister. And so Libby and I got to know each other quite well, and we even had a date together. So my brush with the Gates family and the tradition there is that I dated Libby for once. You know, Libby Gates, my brush with billionaires.
So I was reading on your LinkedIn page that you have built a lot of high performing teams. And as somebody who teaches organizational behavior and why people do what they do in the workplace, I'm really interested in how you did that.
Well, it's a great question. And the key is hire in the hiring process, you know, from the very beginning. There's a whole different set of challenges when you inherit a team or a team. You know, there's been number of reorganizations where, you know, you get people on your team and the alignment of vision and values is key. So whether that's you're hiring people that are aligned with that vision and values, or you bring in people or have people brought onto your team, kind of the assessment at the foundational level of where they're at with what their values are. And in my case, I'll just talk about the last part where it was a partner. They had to have a passion for partners, a lot of self-initiative. So there's a set of values that you just have to make sure at that foundational level. Then you got to get out of their way once you really have that foundational layer. They know what the goals are. They know what the targets are. And especially at Microsoft, it's very data-driven. Very objective metrics that we're achieving, very, very scorecard focused. So you're very clear on what the goals are, you know what the fundamentals are, and you just get out of their way. You're not micromanaging in any way, but so I acted more as a coach than anything else. I really almost have an issue with saying manager. Because it's almost insulting to these really high performing people that are very, very smart, clearly, and they need somebody to talk with, and they need to, you know, talk through an issue or a challenge with. And I love that as a manager, just being able to whiteboard an issue with somebody. Even if it's internal politics and navigating internal politics, but everybody, even the high performers, need to just have a sounding board. So having that foundation, clear goals with objective metrics on measuring that success, and then getting out of their way to just help them, whether it's resources they need or advice and guidance, but getting out of their way to let them really shine is, I think, the best way to get really people to perform at their highest level.
Yeah, I really appreciate your perspective on that, because my previous career was in recruiting before I went back to academia. So I do agree that if you get the right people in place from the start, it does help quite a bit and allow you to hire maybe for fit in that way. And then, you know.
It's not always easy. And you know, I always say, you'll appreciate this in recruiting. What I say is a job of a hiring manager is like a risk management, your risk mitigation, really, where, you know, obviously if you're hiring somebody, you want that person, you want as much assurance that person is going to be successful in the role as possible. The worst case scenario is hiring somebody that just isn't going to work out and you're going to have to let them go at some point, or they're just failing or they're struggling or whatever. So, but the highest assurance is somebody that you've worked with before that has a track record of success doing that thing that you want them to do. The highest risks are somebody completely outside the company, doesn't know, you know, you don't know if they have the track record in this kind of culture, in this kind of environment. So those are really the toughest kind of hires to take the leap of faith on. References help, but, you know, it really doesn't substitute for your personal relationship. So it's no surprise that a lot of managers hire people that they've worked with previously, that they know and they trust, and they can, like Mike did with me. I was no way near qualified for that role that he had open. But he just hired me because he knew that I would figure it out and be successful in that role. the highest risk are those people that you've never worked with, that don't have references from internal to the company or that have no track record within that discipline. So a lot of the interview questions are like, have you ever done this? Or you ever done, you know, see if there's any sort of experience that you can leverage to say they will be successful in this role. So it's always tough for students, especially when hey, I have no experience. Like, yeah, that's the big challenge that you have to overcome is, you know, that's why internships are so important and why relationships through networking is so important. Because if you're just coming in cold with no references, no within the company, with no experience that you can leverage to convince that hiring manager, it makes it a very tough and high risk hire for that hiring manager.
You know, as you're speaking, I keep thinking about like servant leadership and your approach to developing others. And I saw throughout your career, even from your time at GU and being the president of the Associated Students and some of the volunteer work you've done, being on the Board of Regents here now, working with the Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Puget Sound. Where do you think that drive to be of service to others comes from?
I credit a lot of that to Gonzaga. I went to a Jesuit high school as well, but we had one Jesuit. It was essentially run by the School Sisters of Notre Dame. So I think there was a little bit of a foundation from high school, but it really got reinforced at Gonzaga. And the desire to give back was instilled there. I think Gonzaga, you know, the Jesuit philosophy, the Jesuit teaching traditions emphasizes that servant leadership kind of role. And typically at Microsoft, frankly, that doesn't do very well. It's a pretty cutthroat environment. I think that actually that helped me in some ways differentiate myself in that I was really focused on helping others be successful, and that made me successful within Microsoft. It's a challenging environment in that way, but.
So all these, a variety of experiences, not typical for someone who was thinking accounting to start out to end up in marketing. What advice do you have for freshly minted Gonzaga grads as they're about to embark on this journey?
The biggest thing I think, you know, you can see that throughout my career is leveraging the Microsoft and Gonzaga. Leveraging the Gonzaga network to the hilt. You know, I talked about this at the Seattle Trek as well. I get it. When you say networking to a student, that just, just sounds so unethical almost, where you feel like you're manipulating or whatever. It's not that at all. I think they need to change their mindset of there's a whole network of people out there that have a common connection with you, which is Gonzaga, that gives you the automatic card to say, hey, I could use your advice and help. They want to give back. They have that servant leadership that you talked about earlier, where they have an affinity for Gonzaga. They put themselves out there to say, I want to help, just reach out and help. Take advantage of that, and not in a, you know, like a burden way, but be curious, like talk with them about their career and what they've done and what their advice is, get to know them, they get to know you. And that opens doors. It may not be what you're looking for, but it's something interesting to explore. If you think about it as a curiosity, an interest, whether or not it has some tangible outcome at that moment, you know, I played trumpet with Mike Lucarelli. Who would have thought, you know, 20 years later that we were, you know, had lunch together and he offers me a job? You know, that wasn't even in the top of my mind at all. But leveraging that Gonzaga network is probably the biggest advice that I could give. And it kind of ties back what I was saying about hiring managers being risk mitigators. You know, they, without a reference, without a connection, it just makes the prospect of landing that job, whether it's right out of school or, you know, even once you're in the workforce, very, very challenging to overcome. And that Gonzaga network is a great resource that can't be understated on how it can help you. Jim Day, you know, was considered one of the bigger, you know, networkers around, and he was a great resource both when I was seeking a new opportunity and bounce ideas off Jim, but gosh, I can't tell you how many times he referred students to me when I was at Microsoft. Leveraging that network is huge. Eileen Beattie was very helpful to me at the beginning of my career. Mike Lucarelli was a key resource, obviously. I hired Gonzaga grads at Microsoft. Robbie Pazansky was a Microsoft student contact on the campus at Microsoft or at Gonzaga, and he stood out to me because he was so articulate. And so when I had an opening for a role on my team, or it actually wasn't even on my team, it was in the group that I was in, but not on my team. I recommended Robbie and he got the job. And then he ultimately worked for me for a couple of years. He's doing incredibly well at Microsoft. He's already at a director level and all sorts of interesting opportunities under his belt already. I'm just super proud of Robbie and everything that he's done. And that was all just from a very loose Gonzaga connection that helped him stand out and made him a good candidate for this role that I could recommend him for. So leveraging that Gonzaga network is just, I can't overestimate how important that is to do.
Excellent advice.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us. Good talking to you.
Sure.
This podcast has been a production of the Gonzaga University School of Business Administration and was edited by Colby Verhoeven. Thank you to our hosts, Professors Stephanie Van Dellen and Andrew Brasich, and thank you for joining us.